Welcome to Real Science Radio. Fred Williams here with Doug McBurney, joined once again by Dr. Pete Moore. Today we wrap up our series on Einstein's theory of relativity. Over the past few shows, we've exposed its many flaws and introduced a powerful alternative. In this final episode, we'll tie it all together and show why the future of physics may lie beyond Einstein.
Nikola Tesla said this: light can be nothing else than a sound wave in the ether. This guy's highly respected for all the patents that he's done.
Oh, absolutely.
The alternating electric motor.
Yep.
He's a genius. And this is what he had to say about light. It is a sound wave in the ether. And then he goes on to say, in an article that was picked up by the New York Times back in 1934, that article says, "We have made sure by experiment," said Mr. Tesla, "that light propagates with the same velocity irrespective of the character of the source. Such constancy of velocity can only be explained by assuming that it is dependent solely on the physical properties of the medium, especially density and elastic force." Now notice, he puts it solely on the physical properties of the medium, not on the speed of the observer that was watching it.
Right, right. And we have to keep in mind that while Nikola Tesla did have some fantastical ideas, he did come up with radio and alternating current, real things that really work to this day.
Absolutely.
And look what he says in this quote here that you're sharing with us, Dr. Moore. "We have made sure by experiment." So I want to say something else that Nikola Tesla said. Quote, "Today's scientists have substituted mathematics for experiments, and they wander off through equation after equation and eventually build a structure which has no relation to reality."
That sounds like the Sir Isaac Newton warning.
It sure does.
Right? In different words.
You got to go back to our last show to find out what the Isaac Newton warning was. But man, doesn't this sound a lot like the special theory of relativity wandering off after equation after equation? So, good stuff.
Now, let's go look at what he said. I'm going to circle a word here. See the word density? What is density? Density is mass per unit volume. Mm-hmm. So this ether that he's talking about here must have mass per unit volume. And guess what? Look at the word mass. What is mass? Look in our universe today. Show me something that's mass. It's always a particle.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. We've got back to Simoni's particles, haven't we? By another method, by another man, it's implying particles. This is a YouTube video screenshot of a group that studies wave theory, energy wave theory. And they have some excellent, excellent things. And this was one screenshot I took. And in it, they say the equations of energy wave theory require a density constant to accurately calculate particle energy and force. Without it, the calculations are not even possible. Look what they say there. I'm going to blow it up for you. Boop. "Density properly implies waves traveling in a medium with given mass per unit volume." Mm-hmm. We got back to the same thing that Tesla said. What is mass? In our universe, anything you can show me that we can weigh is a particle.
Yep.
Period. Mm-hmm. So these people are strongly implying that whatever this ether is, the equation itself is pointing you toward mass and particles in a unit volume, and you saw the beautiful unit cube that Simoni has for it. If you want to look at more of their stuff, I'm not trying to steal their stuff. I'll advertise it. Here's their YouTube link. You can go there, and they have many very good things on energy wave theory, but this is one of them. Now, we've got to go back and find out. We couldn't use the entrained ether. We couldn't use a rotating ether because of the problems. I'm going to now suggest the solution to that. There's another one. So we got the same Earth. We're going to send it off on its course. But before we do, remember that the blue in this picture is the ether. And Simhoni is showing the ether can be contaminated by a nuclear particle. Well, what's a nuclear particle? Well, every atom on planet Earth, whether it's sodium or chloride, has a nucleus. Those nucleus are real tiny, and they actually can go inside this Epola cube. There's always eight to a cube, and the nuclear particle can get in. But when it goes in, notice what's happening if you get bigger and bigger mass particle. You see it beginning to distort the Epola. The Epola is distorting and getting a higher volume once that particle gets inside it. Here's the Epola, a 2D, with one of the particles in the middle. Notice the distortion. Remember, well, let's cover this first. Mass is an inclusion in the ether. It is taking pure ether, and then you stick something in it. That becomes an inclusion or a contaminant, but it also distorts the ether and lowers its density in that little region. So we're going to send our planet, our Earth, around the sun. Before we do, I want to go back to Albert Einstein. Now, we've given him a few black eyes so far, but I don't want to underestimate what he really has done. And one of the things you have to give him credit, he finally said there is an ether. He does allow a distortion, which is a movement of that ether, and you can see the movement above, creates the gravitational field. He said distortion of the ether then, or distortion of space, is what creates gravity. And I believe he's absolutely correct, and it even is in accordance with Simhoni's Epola model of space.
So you're saying it's not time dilation.
Right. I'm going to let the Earth create a gravitational field in the ether where the now watch the rotating Earth. It'll kind of turn a bubble of blue. That bubble of blue is the distorted ether.
Okay.
So it is creating in the volume of the mass of the Earth a part of the ether that is totally different than it was. The Earth mass distorted the ether. And that distortion stays with the Earth. When the Earth goes, it's not dragging the ether. It's dragging the distorted shape of ether.
And that's going to get you the null result.
And that is exactly right. You're thinking beyond me, and that's exactly right. This particular distorted ether is different than the ether all around it. It travels with the Earth, and therefore the Earth is standing still with regard to its own gravitational ether field. Does that all make sense?
It does.
Well,
make sense.
Number one, if that's not weird enough for you, you're just too weird, okay? That's weird enough for me. But does this explain why it appears gravity propagates instantaneously?
Gravity does not go instantaneously. Gravity is thought, even by a secular scientist, to travel at the speed of light. And it actually should travel at the speed of light because the same ether controls the speed of light. And so it also is going to control the reactions of gravity.
Okay.
So now we go to the professor from Colorado University, Mr. Beckman, on page 28. He said he disagrees with the entangled or entrained ether, where you jerk it out and drag it around or rotate it clear out to who knows where at thousands of times the speed of light or millions of times. He said it's not entrained ether, but it's local gravitational field ether. He and Einstein are almost laying on top of each other here.
Yes.
But in doing so, Einstein never told you what the ether was, and he's waiting for you to figure out one that could follow the Earth, so he didn't know about this. This is the solution that actually knocks his theory right out of the ballpark.
Exactly. And this Peter Beckman from CU, he was a critic of special relativity, but he wanted there to be another competing model.
And unfortunately, he died before Simony had put forth this model. He would have been elated to know that the model of Simony gives the gravitational field he talked about, because he knew if you could go with the gravitational field ether, it solves the Michelson-Morley equation.
Yep.
Solves the MMX mystery. Now, this distorted ether is going the exact same speed of the Earth. And now when you do the light experiment, you will get the right answer. Right. Now, to show you how a nuclear particle goes through the ether, it does so frictionless. It's like if you look at a frictionless bearing, what's the best frictionless bearing we have? Take two magnets, North Pole, hold them together, rub them together. They slide apart. They don't want to touch, and they don't generate heat. They actually push apart, and that is frictionless. So this nuclear green particle is now going to go through the ether, the Simony ether. Now get this. As it goes in, it takes energy to force that electron and positron apart. They are strongly adhering to one another. But as it passes it, they come back together on the backside and give it back the energy it took. So once it's moving, it will move forever.
Okay.
And cool. So this seems to be getting at the light, the wave-particle duality, and how we think we're seeing a photon pop out of,
wave-particle duality is when that little green particle goes through, it's actually opening, before it gets to the particle is already opening up and setting up a wave motion in front of that green particle.
Ah, okay.
So your wave duality is that it sets up a wave in the ether. Before it quite gets there, it opens it up so that it can get through. And once it gets through, it imparts the energy back so it can go the next inch.
Right. So photons aren't popping out of nowhere.
That's correct. Now look at this. We have here a 2D model of the ether. And let's take a helium nuclei and bring it in. An alpha particle. See how that spread them apart?
Yep.
The ether distorted. When you have mass distorting the ether, like Einstein said, it creates gravity. And I'll show you that a little bit later. This produces gravity, as we shall see. I will get to that. If you look at a cube, now it's kind of a 3D. Think on each of those corners, an electron or a positron all the way around. And now, let's look at a 2D slice of the ether, or the epola, and I'm going to create an inclusion in one of those right there. Now, with one piece of mass, the particles on the left and the right, they're trying to pull together, but through that dotted line, they're actually touching one another, like with a magnetic push-off.
Mm-hmm.
On the right and the left side, what's the distance, a vertical distance between those? Are they the same?
No.
So to the right and the left of that big black thing, the vertical distance is a certain thing, and on the left side, it's about the same. You make a perfect square. See that perfect square around it? So in this case, there's no net force that's bigger on one side than the other in the horizontal direction. But watch what happens if I put a second particle. What happens? Now look at what happened. On one side of each of those black dots, it's tall or further apart, meaning weaker. And on the right side of that right one, it's smaller. Now you have a net different Coulomb force. Now you have a differential. And where they're closer together is stronger. It's going to push that particle on the right to the left. And the left particle, if you go to its left, that's closer together than the one in the middle. So both of these is going to create a push force driving them together. It's the differential electric force based on those trapezoid shapes that is now encompassing each of the particles.
Okay.
You don't have it if you have one particle, but you do when you have two particles.
This is tension forces.
Right.
Okay.
Some people say, well, those dotted lines and the frictionless, are you sure that science? Well, look what... This is exactly what Maxwell wrote. He has a magnetic field circle and electric field particles that he thought were like ball bearings. All I have done is taken the electric one and put it in the middle of the big one, because the spinning electric is what makes the magnetic.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So when I go back here, my red and blue dots are in the middle of that magnetic field, and his are kind of on the outside. But he had the same kind of an idea.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if you want to study a little bit, there's the link. Now, if you look at it, zoom way out instead of, and look at it of all of space, if we have a particle, green represent low pressure or low density around that particle where the ampulla is expanded. The purple is representing more dense. So if you sum up in this direction all of the various layers of pressure and compare that force of those pressures to the other side, they're the same. They're symmetrical. Up and down, they're symmetrical. The particle is not going to move if there's just one particle in the distorted ether. The green is the distortion, and then there you have it. Net force is zero. The object will not move. But when you have two of them, and you bring them somewhat close together, what happens in the middle is turning greener and greener in the middle. And now, when you sum these, you get a net difference. Same thing with the other particle. You get twice the green in between, and so it has a net force. And now the two can begin to come together. The equilibrium and non-motion has been reestablished. So it's just another way to do it. Now we know what gravity is. Distortion of the ether creates an offset electrical force that pushes those particles. Now, Einstein drew the expanded space, and this is one that's on the internet. But when you look at his grid, expanded grid, and he's not showing you the one that goes inside the Earth, just the stuff that's on the outside, you get this. The question is, what is the grid with Einstein? He doesn't tell you the grid. Mm-hmm. When I ask AI, what is the space of the space-time? It says, it's not physical.
Right. It's they basically, it's nothing.
So we're back to Isaac Newton's warning. Yep. What is the grid? With Einstein, there is no grid. He said, well, I do accept ether, but he didn't tell you what the ether was. Simhoni tells you the grid is the ampulla particles.
Yep.
That's the intersection where those grids are intersecting. That's where the particle is. And the particle can be expanded due to the Earth's mass. And that then causes gravity, which then can allow the moon to use that gravity and begin circling the Earth.
Yeah, so you have the gravity, which is a weak force, but this explains how you can have that happen. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So at least Simhoni also agrees with the expanded ampulla for gravity. Einstein is saying distortion is gravity, and we got Peter Beckman saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Einstein throws in time.
Yes. You got to take time out of it and go to regular space. You didn't need this kind of complex thought thing of time somehow and space are all together. They're separate entity. But when you go to space, he got it right. Distortion of space creates gravity.
Okay, also, and the addition of time, the addition of time that that Einstein insisted that time and space are a fabric.
Right.
Right? Okay, so that insertion of time into that whole thought process, that was like one step too weird. That was not necessary. Okay.
And you're exactly right. It was one step too weird. Had he just pulled back on the time part, he'd have got it dead right.
Yep.
And I do have to give him at least that distortion of space is gravity. Okay. Also, distortion of space affects the speed of light. As those particles of the Simhoni model get closer together, light goes faster because it's stiffer. Well, where the sun is, you see that green? That's expanded. Now the particles are further apart from each other, and they can't vibrate because they're less stiff. As you go away from the sun, it gets more compact, and that's where light can travel faster. So light, according to this model, is not a constant. And if you go far out into space, you might find light traveling faster based on this model. So we have slower speed around the sun, and we have faster speed in the outer regions away from all this gravity. Guess what they found? Professor Irwin Shapiro, Harvard, he was the first to notice the unexplained time differences in the Mariner radio signals between Earth and Mars. He assumed it to be gravitationally caused time dilations, per Einstein's theory. But what was really happening is that the speed of light wasn't constant. That's why the signals sometimes were getting to the Earth too fast, and sometimes they were getting to the Earth too slow. You didn't have to go to some abstract time slowed down type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look at how that happens. When you send a signal from Earth to Mars, it goes near the sun. As it goes by the sun, in that region, it's expanded. So the path, if you wait, say, 6 months or a quarter of a year, now they're in this. Now when the light signal goes to Mars and back, those radio signals, notice they don't pass near the sun. They're further away from the sun. The further away from the sun you are, the more compact those particles are, and the faster they vibrate, yep. and the faster the light goes.
Yep.
So now let's put it all together. Notice when the Earth is nearest the sun, the light, it took more time. As you go the other way, the path that is further from the sun took less time. And if it's close to the sun, it took more time because light was traveling slower. It took more time. This is predicted by the Simony-Epola model.
And this contradicts a constant speed of light.
Exactly. This is evidence that the speed of light near the sun versus away from the sun are different. But if you say that, you'll be fired.
Yeah.
So rather than say that, that's logical, you say, it must have been a time dilation.
Time dilation.
Oh, 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 oh.
Wow.
So now we see the time difference. It's really attributed to the speed of light based on a real model of particles that exist.
Right. And just to make it clear, the less dense ether around the sun causes those radio waves to travel more slowly. They take a little longer to get to Earth.
Exactly.
Once we get out into space that's not disrupted by an object, you get faster travel.
It's compact. The electron and positrons are closer together. Therefore, they're stiffer. And if they're stiffer, that's part of the model of speed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very logical and very physically comprehensible.
Well, I was going to say, so you had on that last slide, you had the prediction by Simony's Epola model, which is his ether model of space. So have there been experiments direct to this?
This is the first experiment that showed that this is what Simony would expect. Okay. If you show that there's two paths, one away from the sun, one near the sun, Simony's model said, well, the one that went near the sun ought to be slower.
Yeah.
This is the first data.
So this is the
came in,
data that confirmed.
And it was misinterpreted by saying, well, I can't say light is
different.
I see
what you're
saying.
I'll
be fired.
So that's where they went to the time dilation. So, yeah, because we've always said that prediction is the currency of good science.
Yes.
And he makes a prediction. It confirms his prediction. But instead of the secular scientist saying, hey, wow, this kind of was predicted by Simony, we're seeing what he expected. But no, Einstein's right. He's the Time Magazine's Man of the Year. The liberals love him. I'm going to lose my job. So time dilation.
That's right. And besides that, E equals MC squared.
Oh, yeah, equals MC. For more on that, you got to go back to the last show to find out why E equals MC squared has nothing to do with relativity.
Okay, awesome. So deep space radio signals arriving too soon? Here's an AI overview. Pioneer spacecraft anomaly refers to the unexplained slight slowing down of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft as they moved away from the sun. What was happening here? Light was getting back from those spacecraft. Once they got past Pluto, you know, that radio signal got here too quick. Why? What is wrong? Well, maybe the spacecraft slowed down and they're not as far away as they should be. But if they're far away as they should be, well, then light must be going fast. Oh, we can't say that. We'll be fired.
And I wonder if the anomaly was too great for them to kind of explain it by the speed of that satellite, the Pioneer.
Well, it took them, I think, I think I have that maybe on the next slide.
Okay.
it took them like a decade to get far enough away to where you could finally see the speed was having an effect. So Pioneer 10 went in one direction. Pioneer 11 went in one direction. Radio signals were getting back too fast. Then they sent Pioneer 10 the other side of the sun. And guess what? All of a sudden, the radio signals were getting back too quick again. I mean, we got double trouble here. And it wasn't just those. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 had similar things. And Voyager 1 and 2 were built totally different. Some said, well, it might be the heat capacity of the heating elements within the spacecraft were heating one side of the spacecraft more than the other. And all of that was just saying, you know, I don't want to get fired, so I'm not going to say it was the speed of light that was different. So they kind of brushed it to the side and said, oh, it's probably the heating element inside the spacecraft that caused it to deaccelerate. And that's why it wasn't as far as we thought. But if it was as far as he thought, it's following Simhoni perfectly.
Exactly. Mm.
As you get out into deep space, the Apollo is more compact. It's vibrating faster and carries light faster.
Yep. And you have to make excuses to try to defend special relativity.
And this is his book that I believe I've just now showed you.
Okay.
Is robust.
Matter, space, radiation.
Matter, space, radiation. Invitation to the natural physics of matter, space, and radiation. This is Dr. Simhoni in Israel. We held a meeting in Israel, in Jerusalem, to give him tribute. And I had the pleasure of giving him that plaque he's holding. And scientists from United Kingdom and the United States, about 50 of us, met. We had a dinner for him. We had a PowerPoint presentations of his theory and how all of us are working hard to see and advance his theory. And he accepted the plaque. He almost had tears in his eyes at one point here. Someone finally recognized him, because anybody else, if he's working for them, they'd fire him because he went against Einstein.
Yeah, yep.
And so this is the book that I believe comes closest to totally replacing the theory of relativity. Get back to a real ether with real particles, with real calculated speeds, and you've done it.
Wow.
Okay. I will mention the derivation of G was the one thing he didn't complete before he passed away. Okay. I'm working on that, and I wished others would take a look at it. That, I believe, is buried in his model. You put the math to that model, you should be able to derive the actual value of G from that model.
So our challenge to the audience, if you're watching this show, you made it this far, and we hope you have, because there's been some great stuff. If you can derive the gravitational constant using the mathematics that Dr. Simhoni started.
Simhoni.
Real Science Radio, I'm pretty sure we could get our audience. We've done it before. And even crowdfund or whatever we need to do. We'll do what? We'll throw in 10 grand if you can come up.
Well, wait a second there, Fred.
I would put up part of that.
I would put up part of that.
And well, hold on.
Yes.
Hold on, guys.
Yes.
Now, haven't we already confirmed that Simhoni has already correctly predicted the distance between the particles?
Yes, he has.
The 4.4. Okay, so I think that anybody who's good at math, they've already got too much of a gimme on that. They're going to be able to figure this gravity thing out easily. So I don't know if 10 grand, that might be too much.
I will tell you, I've been working on it for about 3 years. It's not as easy as you might think. Oh. And I think I have probably as good an advantage to figure it out. But there are some really good guys with calculus, differential equations, Laplace transforms, you name it. I think there are some bright guys. However, on the internet, they will tell you, G is the biggest mystery presently in all of science. It is the low-hanging fruit, in my opinion, that's ready for picking.
Yep.
Now, the question I have on the screen is the theory of relativity. What will we do with it? Embrace it or replace it? And I suggest, as Christians, we ought to be working to replace it.
Absolutely.
Amen.
And what you presented today, it explains all the things that special relativity, you know, because friends of mine who are really big believers of special relativity, they're like, oh, look at all these predictions. Look at this, you know, the mercury perihelion, look at these helium atoms and the vibrations and how you see different speeds. And, you know, you can go on and on of these different predictions. Well, this explains it. And I was thinking about while you're presenting this, you know, I used to work for Trimble and I was the team lead for their GPS division for heavy highway equipment. We used to build this device that would track the big Caterpillar tractors because people actually steal those things. I don't know how they get down the highway with them. Those things are huge. But anyways, and track, you know, where employees are working on their equipment within zones. Well, GPS, there's this myth, and I brought it up before in prior shows. There's this myth that somehow GPS supports special and general relativity. That was never true. The way GPS works is you've got ground stations that have proprietary government software that synchronize those clocks every day. And all they did was they sent up satellites with a fudge factor, a digit, a number, to just a slight fudge factor to account for what I suggest is the Ebola, because there are, you know, these things are going to affect the ability for signals to come back. But if you account for that with one fudge factor, you don't have GPS supporting relativity. It never has. Ron Hatch was a pioneer of GPS systems. He has many patents to his name, and he was vocal and adamant that stop saying that GPS satellites won't work without special relativity. There's no, they do not do mathematics on those satellites for relativity. That's too complicated. I mean, imagine writing the software and the amount of time it would take. It doesn't make sense. And I just know from my experience that these satellites they've got a synchronous clock sent to them all the time. And that's why they never get out of step. And then they got the fudge factor. So
it's not related to the theory of relativity. It's similar to E equals MC squared. It's said to, but really isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. And this would help explain, you know, we do have a case where you can say that clocks, not time, can run a little slower up in this ether.
Yes.
And you get it here, you have less effect on the clocks and it'll run a little bit. Oh, wait a minute. Is it, it's faster in space.
It's actually, when you get to the ether in space, the ether is more compact,
and so it's okay. Faster.
So the speed of light goes faster. However, with a cesium atom, its vibration is what they're doing.
Yep.
It can be just the opposite, but it's actually a cause by a different gravitational field is messing with the vibrational motion, not with time.
Exactly, exactly.
You're in a different environment, and if you haven't considered it.
And if you're in motion, you know, velocity, that affects it too. It's affecting the clocks, like you talked about earlier, not time itself. Time isn't relative.
They say the clock runs slower at those high altitudes and in travel. And what we're saying is they may run slower. They very well may.
Yeah.
But don't confuse the measurement of time.
Exactly.
With absolute.
Amen.
Yeah, so run slower with velocity and then run a little faster, you know, with less gravity. And then there's this, there's like a 38 microsecond difference. But we account for that again with synchronizing those satellites. We don't have to do relativistic math.
So fudge factor works just as good.
It works just fine.
Better, probably.
I challenge anybody out there who disagrees with me. If I'm hoping that you're an engineer who still works in the industry, there's this code that actually computes, does something with the relativistic equation. I want to challenge you to comment out that code in your receiver and provide us the data. And I'm telling you, you're still going to be within 3 meters of accuracy. It's not going to affect your accuracy at all. Because the key is, it's the synchronizing of all the satellites. And anyways, I'm going off on a tangent.
All right. Now, let me rein you in, Fred, because I want to let the audience know that I had my tongue firmly in my cheek when I said there was too much of a math gimme, because I don't understand the math. But I do want to suggest that it's quite possible that the reason G gets figured out, it's not going to be related to someone thinking about math. It's probably going to be related to someone thinking about God. And it's going to help someone who knows the math. I'm just going to make that prediction. It's going to be a result of, and I may be quoting Einstein, thinking God's thoughts after him.
Yep.
I believe that's actually Einstein.
I think I showed you why God favors Christians. So whoever figures it out, God, I think, will favor them to figure out. This is the foundation of the whole universe. And this G value is the last remaining big mystery, and I believe it'll be a Christian that figures it out.
Well, yes,
it doesn't have to be me. I'll let somebody else be famous. Yeah. I just want to see it done.
Well, we hope it's you, because then you were on Real Science Radio. So I have to ask you, are you familiar with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake? We had him on the show in January, and he had this great episode on TED TV, or was it, is that right, Doug? TED Channel or TED TV? And he presents this evidence of how the speed of light slowed over time, and it confounded scientists because they didn't understand it. And they were, you know, the measurements, a lot of them weren't disputing the measurements. Well, anyways, eventually they just tied the speed of light to the meter, so you could never, ever detect the speed of light change again because they tied what right. to measure it with. Mm-hmm. So that was a real interesting show, and it just the documentation of how the speed of light has actually decreased slightly over the years. So we had a show on that, and then we've also talked about plasma cosmology, and the real interesting thing that Centerfield has that we still want our, hopefully someone in our audience could try this, he's got evidence that the quantized redshifts that we see in space, that those match the electron jumps. You know, the quantized electrons are quantized wow. around those, the ratios match. And so if that's true, that really explains distant starlight, and it really kind of really helps with the idea of plasma cosmology, zero point energy. Anyways, those are all fun topics. We're going to get into, we're going to have a show on plasma cosmology in the future. Have you looked at all into plasma cosmology?
Not much. I did get his book, Centerfield's book, looked at it a bit. I am not real conversant in that area, but it sounded very interesting.
Yes, yes. Fantastic. Now, before we go, I want to just plant this in your mind, Dr. Moore. One of the things that always made me suspicious of relativity is that relativity asserts that the universe has no fixed direction. There is no center of the universe, there, right? And there's no north, south, east, and west. It's just something we perceive because we're on this ball.
There's no preferred inertial frame, according to that theory. So there's no center of space. There's no preferred spot in the universe.
Right, right. So let me just quote the sons of Korah from Psalm 48. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness, beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. So God dwells in the sides of the north. So that when you said that the electron and the positron, they have a north-south pole.
Yes.
It just reminded me of the Bible. I couldn't, and it brought me to Psalm 48. And so we're not directionless. We're not floating through time and space and history without any direction. We came from somewhere. We are somewhere. We're going somewhere. The Bible tells us where that is. And Christians who know the Bible and think about mathematics and science can tell us more and more about where we actually are and what everything actually is. And that's exciting. And Dr. Moore, just cannot thank you enough for coming on and helping me to understand this better and bringing me closer to God as I realize his book agrees with so much of what we observe in science and mathematics.
And I want to thank you, Doug and Fred, both, for allowing me a small platform of time to even discuss this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been planning or wanting to do a in-depth show on relativity for years, right, Doug? We started talking about it, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago and just kept it on the production schedule and kept it there. And then finally, I ran into this email about this guy named Dr. Pete Moore. And he mentioned something about relativity. So it piqued my interest. And I found out you've been studying this for years.
Yes.
It's been a passion of yours. So what a blessing it was for us to cross paths. I think even unrelated topic. I think it had to do more with the hydroplate. But somehow something came in there about relativity. I'm like, huh. Hey, what's your opinion on that?
Well,
so God brought it together, you know.
It was.
Amen.
Well, Dr. Moore, again, what a privilege it was to have you here talking about special and general relativity. And you've issued a challenge to the creationist community, try to solve G using Simhoni's model. And you've provided a good substitute for it. And we have to decide, are we going to discard relativity or continue to embrace it. And I think it's time to discard it. We know it's an uphill battle, but you've presented some really good evidence. A competing model that explains everything that's thrown at you to support special and general relativity. So thank you for that.
And people can start by ordering his book online and diving into his explanation of the math and how he discovered the EPOLA. And I am hoping that there are Christian young men that are listening to your show that will be challenged and will say to themselves, you know, I'm pretty good at math and I am a Christian.
Yeah.
I do have an advantage, and go after it. And let's see the next big discovery with a big green C put on their name.
Amen. Now, before we go, Fred, I do want you guys to know that I fully support the $10,000 award that I will also contribute to. That, by the way, if you solve it, you'll get the award from Real Science Radio right away. We'll send you that check really quickly. Now, I'm not sure what the Nobel Prize is. Is that like $1.2 million still?
I don't know. I just know from last show that Einstein's ex-wife got all that money.
I was going to say we could ask Einstein's ex-wife. But here's the thing. The thing about the Nobel Prize with a discovery like this, probably won't get it until after you're dead. With the Real Science Radio Award, you're going to get to enjoy that money now. So that's get to right. work on that.
If you work for a secular university, you might get fired.
Yeah.
And that's a reality.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So for Dr. Pete Moore and my co-host Doug McBurney, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.